The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, guys. It occurred to me pretty early in discussing with the two of you, that I mean, there's just a ton to talk about, but I think it's useful to take maybe a step back and not just jump into the moment that we're in right now and talk about how we got here. You guys are both, you both tell stories for a living. I would be interested to hear the story of 2016 from the different perspectives that you all come from. Maybe just start with that.
Hi, so the story of 2016 is a story that can also start in 2008. Of course, it could start in any year going back forever, but I do think it's useful to start in 2008 with the financial collapse. I think that, that wasn't the first important collapse in recent American history. There was another collapse in the 1970s, the collapse of the grand bargain between labor, between capital, this uneasy truce that still continued to be, a class war, even as it was a sort of like truce. And once it collapsed, basically neoliberalism began this sort of march toward privatization, towards austerity regimes, and asserted over the decades that there is no alternative. There is no alternative to capitalism at all. And people's lives continued to get worse, poverty continued to be entrenched, people continued to have to work 1, 2, 3 jobs to pay bills, people's health care costs were rising, our housing costs were rising, and in 2008, the situation got so bad that there was actually a financial collapse, and as a result, there became a sort of crack in the there is no alternative. Basically, people started to feel, because of personal reasons, that there has to be an alternative. It's not actually possible that there's no alternative. But there wasn't actually a force at the time articulating an alternative in a way that was easy for people to understand and easy to latch onto. But I think that's the seeds of 2016 right there, is people actually searching for an alternative where before perhaps they weren't. We started to see glimmers of this with Occupy Wall Street, with Black Lives Matter, but Bernie Sanders turned American politics completely upside down. There's no question about that. He articulated a positive alternative to neoliberalism, to deepening poverty, to endless privatization, to oligarchy and corruption, to predatory capitalist industry, to the yawning gulf between the rich and the rest, and to our society's total subservience to the profits of elites. Articulating a positive alternative to these things in the form of universal social programs for all, funded by taxing the rich, things that we haven't heard in the United States in decades. And interestingly, he gave Hillary Clinton a run for her money, and it was a lot of money. And nobody expected that. I don't think that he expected that. I think that was, there are some subjective reasons why. I think that Bernie Sanders is an incredible, he has an incredibly clear, easy to understand analysis of capitalism that resonates with millions of people. I think there are also just objective reasons why that happened. People became disillusioned with the idea of there is no alternative to capitalism in roughly 2008 or starting in 2008. And then over the years of struggle, people learn through struggle. People learn through trying things out. And we've had years of small sort of like upstart, like semi-rebellions, right? People have learned, people have been watching, people have been thinking. And I think that wave actually carried Bernie Sanders in large part, as much as he carried himself. And then, Trump won, right? So I think actually Trump winning really is an important part of this story, in part because I think there are a lot of people who were radicalized by Bernie Sanders who would not have then self-identify as socialist had Trump not won, but that was the thing that pushed them over the edge into thinking like, the Democratic Party absolutely does not know what it's doing, right? Like, and not only does it not know what it's doing, but there's a force out there that knows what it's doing better than it knows what it's doing, and so I'm going to listen to the people who are telling me what the Democratic Party's real motivations are in the absence of the Democratic Party articulating literally anything, or winning anything for that matter. So in this turbulent time of fear and outrage, I think Bernie's vision of democratic socialism has actually taken on a life of its own and has started to develop even further and clearer articulations than the ones that he has been able to offer, or that he's chosen to offer from his sort of pedestal speaking to millions of people, which we've seen in the rise of socialist organizations in the United States. Just speaking in my own organizational context, DSA now has 45,000 members. And we also, I think that it's not unrelated, and I'll get into this a little bit later in the talk, but we also just have the largest strike wave in 40 years in the United States. And I know that not every striking teacher is a socialist, far from it, but I think it's the values the socialists put forward, the values of solidarity, of collectivity, of fighting capitalism, and trying to win liberation for all people, and emancipation from capitalism, those are on the move. And Nancy Pelosi swore after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won, she swore that socialism is not ascendant. I don't mean to recycle a joke, but it occurred to me that this is sort of like if you go shopping for a house and a realtor is like, just so you know, this house is not haunted. Like, I don't know where you're hearing that, but there's like no ghosts at all. socialism is ascendant, right? House is haunted, socialism is ascendant.
Yeah, I also totally agree that it's worth starting by taking a step back, in particular to last night at 2 a.m. when many of you were probably still partying, and so thank you all for waking up so early and coming to this. And I think 2008 and neoliberalism, both of those are essential places to start. And I think in particular, when I think about the change in consciousness since 2008, like in the broadest strokes, like, right, 2008, question capitalism, like you said, right, 2011, 1%, 99%, like a basic class consciousness. Also, everything is connected, right? Occupy Wall Street, everything is connected, and we can do something about it. And then I think it's also really important in 2011 that there were revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa. I mean, multiple revolutions that actually overthrew dictators, 30-year dictators, 40-year dictator, and showed what people can do when they come out. And that was actually obviously also part of the inspiration for Occupy. And then in 2014, and 2013 and 2014, the rise of Black Lives Matter. I mean, if there's one movement, one issue that everybody who's becoming a socialist today, I think, has radicalized around and has gone to protest for, it's Black Lives Matter. I mean, this is, and the centrality of that, I think, for American socialists is, we can't understate that. That this is one of the most important questions for socialists in America. And then actually from 2014 to 2016, like, I was trying to remember, correct me if I'm wrong later, but it didn't seem like that great of a couple of years. I mean, I'm thinking back, the counter-revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa are also important to discuss, right? And the depressing, picture of what's happening in Syria and in the other countries there. And then also just, Black Lives Matter was protesting, but police were still killing black people with impunity. And then, of course, 2016, here comes Bernie Sanders, saying, I'm a socialist, I'm a democratic socialist, we need this, we need a $15 minimum wage, we need healthcare for all, we need free tuition. And I think the two most important things, again, in broad strokes that happened because of his campaign, is to name socialism and to give us kind of a unifying vocabulary and demands, right? One of that tricky question that came from Occupy. And so now socialists and even non-socialists but progressives around the US have shared demands. Medicare for all and free tuition are like national demands. The question of the movement is a whole other issue, but there are demands. And I think then, it's also important to remember the DNC in 2016 kept going after those primaries, and during that week of the DNC, I mean, what a like kind of roller coaster week. I was thinking back, I think that was crucial to kind of what you were saying about how people who voted for Bernie and want to change realize that the Democratic Party doesn't know what it's doing or knows what it's doing really well and is really good at pretending not knowing what it's doing, and then, I mean, crushed Bernie that week. I mean, like, if people remember, they actually, Leon Panetta, right, the ex-head of the CIA, went up to endorse Hillary Clinton, and people, the Oregon delegation, chanted, "No more war, no more war."
Yeah.
And they turned off the lights on those people. The Democratic Party turned off the lights in the convention center. Those people had to turn on their cell phones to keep chanting, right? And then other people drowned them out with chants of USA, USA. Which were on a chant sheet that they had handed out to people, saying, when you hear, they had a chant sheet saying, if you hear no TPP, you chant Hillary, you know, things that kind of sound, I mean, the pettiness is really also shocking. And so I think that week played a crucial role in people's radicalization that year, and then essentially, again, the victory of Trump, which, just to pick one thing out from that in terms of radicalization, I think Trump winning, I mean, not winning the election, but getting into power, winning through the Electoral College, I think it, for a lot of people, it broke the illusion of, yeah, things are bad, but generally there's gradual forward progress. You know, America, for all of its flaws, and the world for all of its flaws, we slowly get better, right? And actually when Trump won was when people looked around and were like, no, we can go backwards. Things could get even worse than backwards. And therefore, I have to do something. I mean, that I think was the moment, like you were saying, you know, when people were like, I have to do something, I have to go out. And I think that that's the story of 2016.
Okay, so here's the section of the discussion where we talk about the who's afraid part, right? Because I think we're all very excited that Bernie Sanders ran, mm-hmm. and it's undeniable that it left an enormous impact both for us and the rest of the country. But there's contradictions to Bernie Sanders running as a Democrat. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think we should be under any illusions that Bernie Sanders' campaign would have looked the way it did if it wasn't run through the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. right? We can discuss, bring that up in discussion if you don't think that's the case, but I mean, so this moment was made possible by the Democratic primary run. At the same time, while millions of people, 13 million people voted for Bernie Sanders, while millions and millions of them and more now identify as socialists, they identify as a socialism that's filtered through the Democratic Party, right? Which is a party of capital, I think we all agree with that. And so, you know, understanding that the Democratic Party is run for and by capital presents an interesting question that I want to hear you guys discuss. Like, we need to have a mass base for socialism in the country to do anything. At the same time, we have to be crystal clear about who our allies are, who our enemies are, and not to be confused about that, because that really does determine the direction a movement can take, and this is probably a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. If we all wind up inside the Democratic Party, or you know, that's a big problem. You know, I wonder what your thoughts are on balancing the contradiction of suddenly having a mass platform, but one that comes with some pretty, you know, some pretty serious strengths attached. We're like, we're in this watershed moment. Like, what do we do?
Yeah, very contradictory. One of Marxist's favorite words as well. So. I think there are a couple things that are essential to talk about in terms of that. And I think, like you said, it's impossible, almost impossible to imagine 13 million people calling themselves socialists based on anything else having happened. Like, what else could have happened in 2016 to do that? And even now with the teacher strikes, which I think are the most essential ingredient as well in this radicalization and in the birth of a new socialist movement, like Megan said, it's not that actually all those people are calling themselves socialists either. And just like in terms of really popularizing this term, getting it out there and building a self-consciously socialist movement. But I think that there are a couple things that I want to get at in whatever 3 minutes that we have. You said the Democratic Party is a capitalist party. If you didn't, he said it before. And so I think it's important to define that. And if people were at the talk yesterday on Democrats and Social Movements, one of the things that they said, which was, I think really crucial, is like, the Democratic Party is not a membership-based party, and if it is a membership-based party, the dues-paying members are the capitalist class, right? They fund the Democratic Party, and they get what they pay for, right? And we get what we pay for. So, that you know, when they were writing the ACA healthcare bill, the healthcare industry had given basically $70 million to $80 million to both McCain and Obama. Obama won, and then Obama appointed the Obama administration, because it's really, you know, appointed the head of one of the, an ex-head of one of the insurance companies, and they write the legislation. We didn't pay $80 million, so we didn't get to write the legislation, right? And so I think that's essential, really. Like, what does it mean to be a capitalist party is essential. And that's I think, what it means. Which then gets to what kind of membership organization do we actually need, which I want to get to in a second. But I think the main contradiction that I think you were getting at, Andor, is really important, is the how radicalization happens, and that it's combined and uneven and contradictory. And so I think your greatest strength is often your greatest weakness. So Bernie Sanders' campaign's greatest strength was popularizing socialism to 13 million plus people, more. But the greatest weakness was also that they popularized socialism the way Bernie Sanders defined it to those 13 million plus people. And I think that's essential because the way Bernie Sanders' campaign defines socialism is very different from the way that I or the ISO or Revolutionary Socialists would define socialism, is that in process and in goals. And so, for example, in goal, wanting free tuition, which we all want, is also very different from wanting the glimpses of what we see about what a socialist education, like liberatory education system would be like, whether you read 10 Days That Shook the World, Eyewitness Account of the Russian Revolution, or in Education and Capitalism, there's a great chapter about May 1968 and what the students did there, or fiction, like The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin, where you get these pictures of like the teachers and students decide what to learn together. They get rid of tests. They decide what they're going to plant in the garden, whatever. I mean, all decisions are made together. It's not just about being able to go for free. It's about running your own education. And similarly with Medicare for All, it would be about deciding we're going to put all of our effort into finding cures for these diseases. Actually, we're not going to keep funding millions and millions and millions of dollars of ED research. We don't need that, right? Like, this is the stuff we need to do. It's not just about getting Medicare for All. It's about deciding as a society what we need. And the process of getting there, which is, so in one of Bernie's books about how we get to a revolution, a guide to a political revolution, he says democracy is not a spectator sport, which is, I think, something that we would all agree with. And then the next sentence is, which is why we need to all vote. And that's something that then is where this question comes up. And at the end of each chapter, there are ways to get involved, but a lot of them are volunteering, volunteering for an NGO, donating money, etc. And this gets back to the membership organization. We need to decide the direction of our movement. We need democratic movements where, as a group, we decide, what are the demands, what's the strategy, and that's because it's not about just electing people who can legislate stuff in. It's about building movements. Most importantly, social justice movements like Black Lives Matter and the labor movement, like the teacher strikes, that have social power that can demand and leverage and push whoever is in office into giving us what we want, like the West Virginia teachers, like all the teachers yesterday. I mean, basically, just imagine. Now I'm going to stop talking. Just then, remember everything they said yesterday. And I think the key thing then is, that's building those kinds of organizations and building a cadre of people who have those relationships with each other and can do that together.
All right, so I'm gonna go a little long on this one because there's a lot to say about the contradictions of the Democratic Party, Democratic Socialists and the Democratic Party. First, I want to start off by saying that I agree with Yoni. Those contradictions are a cold, hard fact. There's no way around them. And coming up against them, I would say, in 2016, coming up against them is precisely what led thousands of people to join socialist organizations, right? And I'd estimate that hundreds of thousands of people identify as socialists of some stripe, though many of them are not on our rosters, and they lack the kind of clear materialist analysis that an organized socialist group can give right now, but we can get them there. We should not delude ourselves that the Democratic Party, operating in the United States, legislative and executive branches, will deliver socialism. Egalitarian worker control of the American economy and society will never be smoothly legislated through that particular party vehicle, which is reliant on major sectors of the capitalist class for the funding of its daily operations, and therefore has an enormous conflict of interest with working class liberation, and the capitalists are going to win that conflict of interest. So we have, just so you know where sort of DSA that on this, we have plenty of paper members who don't necessarily believe what I just said to you. But being, an active organized socialist gives you a different perspective pretty quickly, actually. So I think that I feel confident in telling you that the majority of active DSA members agree with what I just said to you guys, just so you know where people are at. And that is in the, that is like, I would say, yeah, that's if, in the thousands, it's in the thousands. And, you know, I would say that the majority of like the most sort of active like cadre of DSA, Marxist cadre, agree with what Eric Blanc called the dirty rake strategy, which is an attempt to sort of like use the Democratic Party when possible to popularize socialism and build working class struggle with the ultimate aim of building another party vehicle entirely. And just so you know, Julia Salazar, who's a DSA member, who's running in New York, I actually did an interview with her the other day, and she told me, she's running as a Democrat, and this is what she said to me. She said, quote, "My feeling is that the Democratic Party realignment is at best a laudable secondary goal, not a primary goal. Ultimately, the two-party system de facto disenfranchises people, and I can't see the Democratic Party ultimately being a vessel for the Democratic Socialist Revolution. So it would be silly and short-sighted for Democratic Socialists to put a lot of effort and resources into that project." She then said, because she's running as a Democrat, right? She said that, so why is she running as a Democrat? She then said, "It's unquestionably strategic here in New York, though not everywhere, I should add, to run as a Democrat if you want to seize power as a leftist. To mobilize people around socialist politics, you have to engage Democratic voters, of whom there are millions. And you can't do that in any meaningful way without running on the Democratic Party line in my district. I think it would be great if we could all avoid the Democratic Party line, and I think it's still an important question for people running under different circumstances, but if I were to try to do that in this district, I highly doubt people would notice, much less vote for a third-party candidate in a general election." So I think that actually captures pretty well like where a lot of people in DSA are at right now on this question. She's actually running, you know, she's one of our members. She's a sort of like homegrown member. She's been doing DSA activism with her local chapter in New York City for 2 years, which is why she speaks like this. But let me also add that there are pressures beyond the Democratic Party. Through their control and of the investment and employment processes, capitalists hold structural power in the economy that can outmatch progressive legislators. So even if we were to do some sort of like realignment of the Democratic Party, we would come up against yet another layer of contradictions and constraints. If major capitalists strenuously object to literally any given policy, the threat of a capital strike and capital flight has the power to bring the state to heel. That is a contradiction that is, to my mind, even bigger than the contradictions of the Democratic Party. And I think any Marxist worth their salt would have to recognize that the Democratic Party then, therefore, does not have a monopoly on contradictions or constraints. And that even independent socialist politicians, should they actually get enough attention to win in the first place, which, as we've noted, is not very easy, are put in a tough spot and are likely to capitulate under pressure. And I think the pressures that capital exerts on all who hold power in the capitalist state are arguably greater than the centrifugal force of the Democratic Party. So that's just something to keep in mind as we move forward. These contradictions are unavoidable. And yet, the advantages of running Democratic Socialists in large elections are many. Elections with Democratic Socialists running in them raise the expectations of the working class. That's what they do. Last night at the plenary, one of the teacher organizers was very clear that we will not legislate in socialism. It will not be handed to us by politicians, no matter their political orientation. We must force it through mass action. You will hear no argument from me. This is certainly true. I do think, though, that elections and mass action are not mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. Not that I think that teacher organizer felt differently. I'm just saying, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. In fact, I've spoken with teacher organizers from West Virginia and Arizona last night who were talking about, very explicit about the fact that the Bernie Sanders campaign was a political turning point for many of their strike leaders, right? And lent a sense of urgency around class demands to thousands of people who participated in those struggles. And I know that, you know, Eric Blanc spoke to someone in Oklahoma in an article that he wrote for Jacobin, I'm just going to quote it, who said, "Bernie showed how radical Oklahoma was under the surface. Those rallies when he came really inspired and electrified people. He won the Democratic primary in Oklahoma by a huge margin, and he gave an outlet to the deep dissatisfaction that existed with the status quo. People who had been isolated now felt confident and mobilized." And then this person went on to connect that feeling to the eventual, you know, teacher strikes in Oklahoma. So we have to be sober and honest about the fact that electoral politics is it's where the action is for a lot of people. It's not where we think all the action lies as socialists, but it is where a lot of people think politics happens. And as a result of that, presidential elections and are a time, presidential elections in particular are a time when hundreds of millions of people, even people who don't vote, talk about what's wrong with how we structure our society, when who the arrangement benefits and who it screws over, and there are clear protagonists and antagonists in the form of candidates, and those become proxies for protagonists and antagonists in our society. If you have a democratic socialist running, you have an opportunity to change that narrative so that the protagonist is working people and the antagonist is capitalists. If you don't have democratic socialists running, that will not happen at all. And that's actually very natural for working people if someone is giving them an opportunity to think that. So there you can see why it's important to run democratic socialists in big elections. And I think, you know, this is where the lasting contribution of Bernie's 2016 run is. It's that he put class politics, material inequality, and taxing the rich to fund universal social programs back on the agenda for millions of Americans. And another Sanders run in 2020 could mainstream those politics in a huge way. I have too much to say. I'm going to try to keep it a little bit shorter, all right? Let me just say that if you were to run as this is my answer to yet another question. Are we going to talk about Bernie in a moment?
Yep. It's all. If he had won in 20.
Yeah. I actually do want to make a few more points on this one. All right. Look, we can't shield, these contradictions are inevitable and they're a part of socialist struggle. We can't shield Americans from the contradictions of running a socialist in a capitalist country, right? And not least of all because young American workers are moving toward this in droves, independent of any choices we make. We don't have a choice whether or not Bernie runs as a Democrat, we don't have a choice if he runs at all. We need to understand that the fact that much of this is going to happen whether we like it or not. And the organized left needs to actively welcome these contradictions, right? They're inevitable, just like the contradictions of socialist movements that lean on the capitalist state to deliver reforms that are against its own interests, just like the contradictions of electing anyone, including third-party candidates, into a state controlled by the ruling class. And confronting these contradictions, like I said, is a part of class struggle. We can't go around them, we have to drive through them. People develop their political instincts over years and decades of struggle, partial victory, disappointment, regrouping, reassessing. So we as socialists have to steward a generation of newly politicized people through the victories and disappointments that will inevitably come with the new political terrain we find ourselves on. And for that reason, and because that's a primary task for socialists, these contradictions don't, for me, spell way the pros and cons. It's not obvious to me that you should avoid them running democratic socialists as Democrats when you have an opportunity to speak to millions of people or thousands of people, even about class struggle. Yeah, I'll leave it there. More to say.
So I think you said this a little bit in your answer. I just want to draw very shortly, and if you guys have any responses to what you just said, maybe include it in this as well. But so, you know, Bernie would have won is something that we've all heard repeatedly, right? In fact, you can buy it on a checking bag in the market. Only $15. Okay, so let's say so Bernie wins, right? So Bernie wins in 2016, given all the things that we know about the weaknesses of the left and what it means to run U.S. capitalism. Just, you know, briefly, because I think there's some other questions we want to get to, just, you know, say a little bit about what happens as a result of that.
Want me first?
Yes. We'll
just focus on Bernie wins in 2016, and we enter into a new world full of excitement, a lot of excitement, a lot of hope, and a lot of dashed hopes as well. He doesn't have a mass movement behind him right now that could actually mobilize in the numbers that would be necessary to force all of the other politicians who disagree with him to do what he says. I think that it's not possible that he would be able to muscle through every bit of legislation that he, or policy that he wants. In fact, I think that very few of them would end up getting muscled through. And this goes to something that I was saying earlier. For a while, thinking about that, I felt relief I think that Bernie hadn't won because we had this opportunity in 2016, 2017, 2018, and onward to regroup. Because I thought we just weren't ready. And lately, it's started to occur to me that we will never be ready, actually, and that the experience of that disappointment is going to have such enormous explanatory power for people who are deeply materially invested in seeing the kinds of policies that Bernie Sanders wants to make a reality in the United States come to pass. And that especially if we have socialist leadership willing to, offer that analysis and those explanations, that it could really crystallize. If Bernie had won in 2016, perhaps socialist organizations could have taken advantage of that moment. I do think we're better positioned for it in 2020. I also want to say regarding the constraints of capital that we would have seen Bernie himself capitulate to capital, because there is no choice. Like, the executive doesn't get to decide. The executive doesn't get to ultimately. Capitalists hold our society hostage, essentially, with this threat of disinvestment in capital flight specifically. So it would basically come down to Bernie wants to tax the rich to fund universal social programs. The rich don't want to be taxed. They can move. They threaten to move. Bernie has to decide whether he wants all of those jobs to go away, or whether he wants, which will hurt working people, or whether he wants to back down from his program of taxing the rich to fund universal social programs. And we're going to watch that happen, and that's going to be extremely disappointing, but like I said, also possibly clarifying. And I do want to say that there's no way, to my mind, that the situation in the United States politically could worsen under a Bernie Sanders presidency. It could only get better. Like, I mean, literally, it's not possible, as far as I can see, where you would end up having, like, a worse array of policies. So that's actually important to keep in mind. I don't think it can lead to lesser ableism, but I don't wish that we should discard that from the outset. Let's look at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think if would Bernie have won, I really agree with what you were saying, in particular about the importance of an understanding of the state and the ruling class as kind of like the key thing to think about, if Bernie had won in 2016, and in general, if people win. And I guess, Jason invited us to, first of all, please do buy the tote bags. He told me he gets 10% of all sales. You invited us to maybe throw in some stuff from that came up out of the last question. I really loved what you he said. Thank you for all that. So I have a couple thoughts. Let me see. I'll start with the question, and just to say that, like, we don't know what would have happened. I think we can all agree, it's always a difficult answer. So all of these are what could have happened, and I definitely agree, like you said, socialist organization could have grown. The state and the ruling class, in particular through the Democratic Party, because it would just be Bernie in executive without really anyone supporting him in Congress. I mean, that they would have so many other ways before even capital flight that they might not even need to do that. They would threaten it, but to stop him, they had so many other ways. I mean, if people didn't get to go to the talk on Chile in 1973, you have to listen to it when it comes out on We Are Many. And that was when they had a Marxist president, or a social democratic president, and 30 to 40% of parliament was part of his party. And that they crushed that with multiple coup attempts, one successful, obviously, with capital flight, with boycotting the most important copper exports from Chile, which were 78% of their wealth. But we wouldn't even have been at that level, right? If Bernie was president, we didn't have 30% of Congress socialist, right? We had, I think, two people in Congress endorsed him when he ran. So there's so many ways that they could have obstructed him. And I think then all the questions that you raised, I'm just gonna, add on more questions. Like, does that mean people draw the conclusion that, right, like, the Democrats are a party that are against us and against socialism? Or is the conclusion socialism doesn't work, socialism leads to inflation, they're too far left, kind of like the McGovern, the conclusion after the McGovern campaign, actually, you're too far left, and then also, like, the conclusion about, if you draw, like, the first conclusion that the Democrats are against socialism socialism, we need something else, do people draw the conclusion that enough trade wants socialism from above for another and say, okay, we can't just elect someone to legislate it in, we need to have a guerrilla war, right? And you know, Maoists or like the Castro type idea of people arming themselves and liberating the people, or do they draw a conclusion about workers' power and workers' democracy? All of these are questions that I think one of the things that we, you know, we can't control everything, but that's the responsibility. One of the responsibilities of socialists is to try to control what we can, which a lot of the time is like being able to spread our ideas. And I think that, like you said, people's ideas change through activity, and so getting people involved with us in the Medicare for All movement or Black Lives Matter or whatever movements there are, to then make these, you know, to have these discussions out over that time would have been the key ingredient. And I think just two or three hopefully quick things about some of the stuff you were saying before, which are, I mean, I really agree about the kind of, we can't shield Americans from the contradictions, and I think that's what's so amazing about Julia Salazar, like, in that interview saying that, and that, like, that because they could go both ways. Running within the Democratic Party could shield them from the contradictions that we're laying out about the Democratic Party actually being against socialism, which in some ways, I think, you know, the Bernie Sanders campaign did more of, like, was less critical of the Democratic Party, ended up endorsing Hillary Clinton, and is more, I think, of, like, a kind of, like, realignment type strategy with our revolution, whereas it seems like Ocasio-Cortez is kind of then a bit further from that, and Salazar seems even further from that, and it's important for people, you know, to be open about their views on that. And I think that also, I guess, it raises the question also about, like, when does the break happen? And so, like, Bernie Sanders wasn't going to, after the primary, split and run as an independent because of his politics, but hypothetically, you could imagine someone, him or someone else, doing that. That was a moment when people, after the DNC, were disillusioned with the Democratic Party, and there could have been, like, okay, break, we need independent politics. But that's fine, it didn't happen then, but then does that mean in 1 year, in 2 years, in 3 years? Like, that's, I think, one of the big questions. And I think in terms of just also, like, spreading socialist consciousness, which, like, having these debates out at conference this year has been super great, so thank you everyone for all of those. And I think this idea also of, like, the contradictory nature of this, that you spread socialism, but it's a particular type of socialism, definition of socialism, and perhaps rehabilitates the idea of the Democratic Party as a vehicle. It's also about, like, net positive versus net negative. And so some of these, like this, I think, for example, you know, Bobby Seale or other Black Panthers running within the Democratic Party at the end of huge movements, you get mostly net negative. You have a socialist movement and you're telling socialists the Democratic Party is the way. Now, perhaps, I'm thinking this stuff through, so you know, but like, perhaps we're getting more of the net positive, because there is not a socialist movement that is there before that is being brought in majority to the Democratic Party. It's actually mostly saying, you know, bringing in new people to socialism. That doesn't mean that in 1 year it stays the same. That's the whole point, that this could then very quickly become socialized, and I think I'm being
Could I respond to that directly?
Yeah, why not? Yeah.
Yay. We talked beforehand, we're like, this might just turn into a conversation. yeah, okay, so that the last point that you made is extremely important, I think. Right now, there is not a mass independent socialist movement that is in danger of being co-opted by the Democratic Party. There is a nascent independent socialist movement that was largely, it's in its most recent iteration, largely born out of a sort of exodus from the Democratic Party caused by the sort of like energy and dynamism that's happening in the left wing of the Democratic Party. So like that's where the movement is, like the dynamic sort of energetic movement is happening right now, largely among like progressives who don't really know what to think. And I think that it's socialist responsibility to like go in there basically and like shepherd progressives. I'm gonna say also, not our primary goal is not to shepherd progressives out of the Democratic Party. Our primary goal is to shepherd progressives out of an understanding that capitalism is somehow compatible with a good life for all people. Like, that is actually our primary goal. And I actually think that it's a precondition for understanding that the Democratic Party is not going to save us, is understanding that capitalism is not going to save us, right? So, like, I think there's a sort of fixation on whether or not we're accidentally helping or hurting the Democrats, or that you should probably try to, in my mind, try to background a little bit while we focus on the particular question in front of us, because of the current material conditions that we have in front of us right now. There are large numbers, I'm going to say millions of people who are questioning not just the utility of the Democratic Party, but the utility of capitalism. The only way to get through the question of the utility of the Democratic Party in a long-term sense is to actually reach in there as socialists and steward them out of any remaining faith they may have in capitalism. That's our primary goal right now, not to play some sort of long game with the Democratic Party. It's really about building socialist consciousness, socialist working class consciousness and power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, just one more contradiction that I really want to talk about really quickly, the excitement contradiction. So there's this question about, can we be excited about Ocasio-Cortez or Sanders running but not have been a part of the, and I think it's related to a part of the campaign, I think it's related to that question you were saying about the contradictions of just being in power in the state, whether it's an independent socialist or within the, whether you're an independent party or the Democratic Party, which is totally agree with, but I think it's also a focus on the person winning, and that is the goal, whereas I think the excitement is about the 13 million people who voted for Sanders, or the 16,000 people who voted for Ocasio-Cortez, and the 1,000 people who joined DSA, and the other 1,000 people who are interested in socialism now. And so that I think is part of why the excitement contradiction is a little bit less of a contradiction, because it's not,
People were nodding, so.
Great.
I don't think about the contradiction of the moderator.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.